Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, can we use the word cure when it comes to a cutting-edge therapy for some forms of blood cancer? Groundbreaking researcher Carl June is our guest. And later, we sit down with the new president of the Free Library of Philadelphia, Kelly Richards. But to begin, for those of us who suffer from seasonal affective disorder, the increasing sunshine of spring and summer can't get here fast enough. The days are getting longer, but there is at least a month of winter left on the calendar. SAD, as it's known, is more than just a case of what's called the winter blues. It's a major depressive disorder, and experts say if left untreated, seasonal affective disorder can worsen and lead to issues at work and school, substance abuse, even thoughts of suicide. Our guest is Dr. Stephanie Marcello, chief psychologist for Rutgers University Behavioral Healthcare. And Stephanie Marcello, so good to have you with us.
It is great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Let's begin by talking about seasonal affective disorder and, you know, what are commonly called the winter blues. How do we differentiate?
So when we think about seasonal affect, winter blues are things that can happen to all of us. I think one of the biggest things when we look at seasonal affective disorder is it is a major depressive disorder, is that it is clinically and significantly interfering in areas and aspects of our lives. So we have to have over two winters. Typically, we start to see symptoms appear in October and last for about 5 months. So you've had to have that two winters or two seasons, actually. I know we're talking about the winter blues, but it has happened in the summer for people, too. So two seasons where you experience these symptoms. And they are pretty significant symptoms. These are feeling persistently down or sad every day, nearly every day, losing interest or pleasure in things. So not doing things that you typically used to enjoy, like seeing friends and family or hobbies, eating too much or too little, gaining weight, losing weight. One of the biggest things is sleep disturbances. So I always look at that when I'm working with people. Are they having insomnia or difficulty falling or staying asleep? One of the biggest things we notice about seasonal affective disorder is that people feel pretty persistently tired and fatigued. So that seems to be one of the most universal symptoms.
And sometimes they can even experience thoughts of suicide?
About 30% of people who have seasonal affective disorder have endorsed some thoughts of death or suicide. So when we start to hear people in our lives talking about feeling hopeless or worthless, we really want to listen up and make sure that they get evaluated by a professional. Also, trouble with concentrating. And it's not, you know, we all have some trouble concentrating and focusing at certain parts of the day, and we probably even joke around about it a lot, but this is so debilitating that individuals can't function in the way that they function during other seasons of the year.
Stephanie Marcello, does seasonal affective disorder affect women and men equally?
It does not. Like most depressive disorders, women experience, and honestly, we're not really sure why. There are some hypotheses, but women experience seasonal affective disorder significantly more than men do. One of the hypotheses that we tend to look at is that we tend to ruminate more. So ruminate, when we have a thought in our head, it tends to grow and grow and grow and expand. And women tend to biologically do that more, and probably environmentally too. So I think it's a combination than men. And so sometimes that can make depression symptoms even worse.
And has the
it's pretty significant.
Oh, I'm sorry. So let's talk about the pandemic for a moment. Has that made things worse for people with seasonal affective disorder or tendencies toward it?
I think that we have seen major depressive disorders significantly increase, especially amongst women, especially among mothers, as well as anxiety disorders. Seasonal affective disorder I haven't noticed a significant increase in seeing SAD. I've noticed an increase in depressive disorders because there really is something about seasonal affective that is that slow-running biological clock.
Yeah.
So I haven't noticed that, but I have noticed depressive disorders going up.
So what is happening in our bodies as SAD emerges?
So there is still debate in the research. So we still actually need more research in this area. Seasonal affective disorder hasn't really been talked about since 1980 is when we really first start to recognize something was going on with people. So there's a lot more research and NIH trials that are currently happening. One of the things is environmental triggers. So there's something called a photoperiod, and that's the day length. So think about it. It's just the numbers of hours and minutes in a day. and between dawn and dusk and sunrise and sunset, that changes. So there's some for the biological that we look at the biological clock, and something happens where it slows down in the winter months. That's why people who live further from the equator in the United States have more cases of seasonal affective disorder.
Okay. So when do people start to move out of seasonal affective disorder then? At some point in the spring, obviously, but what is it March or April?
So January and February tend to be the months where people's symptoms tend to be the most debilitating. And about March is when they'll start to notice improvements.
What does sunshine do for us?
Sunshine helps with the biological clock. Sunshine helps with our vitamin D. Really, the lack of sun exposure is what causes seasonal affective disorder, one of the symptoms. And so getting as much sun, sitting by a window, going for a walk, anything that you can do, even sitting by a window has shown to be really highly effective, can help you soak up that vitamin D, soak up the sunshine. That helps people and it helps their biological clocks.
Are vitamin D supplements helpful?
So there has been some research that they are, although if someone is experiencing, you know, a major depressive disorder and has seasonal affective disorder, we really want to get them into treatment. I don't think that vitamin D would be it. It could be one part piece of it. They really need photolight treatment has been shown to be highly effective. Wellbutrin, I think, is the only SSRI that is prescribed right now for seasonal affective disorder, and cognitive behavioral therapy have shown to be sort of the three major treatments for SAD right now.
So photolight therapy, how does that work?
So that is, it helps with that photo period. So it's essentially a lamp, if we can think of it in its sort of simplest terms, that people will sit under to help increase those fluctuations in that in their brain.
And can you just order one, say, on Amazon? I mean, is it easy to get a hold of them, or do you need to go to a doctor to talk about getting the proper photolight therapy treatment?
I think that you really want to, if you're doing light therapy, have a recommendation from a professional in the field to really ensure that it's one that someone in the field would prescribe for somebody or recommend. It really, what it does is it kind of, if you think about like jump starting your clock, think about your internal clock, and that's mm-hmm. really what it does. It helps to put it back into like a normal phase. So it's more like in the months where we get more sunlight.
Do we see that children are affected by seasonal affective disorder?
So right now the diagnosis is for adults. I can't imagine why children aren't affected by it, but I've never worked with a child who has this diagnosis, because right now most of the treatment is looking at adults with seasonal affective disorder.
Yeah, but if a child seems to experience the changes you described earlier in the conversation, the red flags that might prompt an adult to seek health care, the wisdom would dictate then that, you know, a parent or caregiver might take the kid to a pediatrician.
Absolutely. I think if you're noticing any signs in your child, I think one of the best things we can do is talk about it, get the information out there. Don't try to just deal with it, you know, between your family and your child. Get a professional involved because you don't have to suffer with seasonal affective disorder. And I would actually, I really do want to reiterate the light therapy because it's not FDA regulated.
Okay.
So I think for the layperson to figure out all of those products on Amazon, you don't need a prescription, but I don't think that I would go online and buy that myself without looking at ones that have been tested, maybe in a random clinical trial.
And check with your doctor always, especially with something like a major depressive disorder. So let's talk about something kind of easy to take a look at. I mean, it's easy to love carbs during the winter, but are they the best foods when it comes to treating something like this or helping to treat seasonal affective disorder?
Absolutely not. So one of the things we noticed, I think all of us do this in the winter. You want more. I know I do. Carbs, sugary food.
Yep.
But especially people with seasonal affective disorder may find themselves sort of craving these kinds of things. And you think about almost like comfort. If you're feeling if you're feeling really down and unhappy and you're really struggling, there's something about in that moment that we find comfort in those things, not probably after we're done eating them. But even when we think about the impact that all of that sugar has on our chemicals in our brain, that's not what we want to focus on. Really, the way we eat is important.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of comfort foods that don't involve carbs. Do you have anything in mind, Stephanie?
Maybe you could try making a dessert from seasonal fruit, something like apples and pears, instead of eating cake and cookies. Or we can get creative, look for like low calorie recipes that might be easy to prepare. So things that aren't loaded with extra calories and lots of fat and sugar. I make a lot of like very healthy, even gluten-free muffins and cookies that kind of satisfy that for you. Or sometimes having a cup of warm tea that maybe is like a French vanilla flavor. So it's still a little sweet, but you're having something that's also kind of taking care of you in a wellness type of way, something warm.
Sure. We've got a comment from Joan who says, three things that have helped me are my photo lamp in the morning for 30 to 40 minutes, exercise, and meditation. And she says there are some great guided meditation services online. What are your thoughts there?
I think that she just nailed it. I think that meditation is so powerful. And here's for so many reasons, but here's why, particularly for seasonal affective disorder and depression. One of the things that depression does is it takes us out of the moment. So if you're having depression symptoms, you tend to be ruminating maybe on things in the past or focusing on things that, you know, we really can't control. When you have anxiety, you tend to be focusing a lot on things in the future, worrying what's going to happen, right? That ruminating I talked about. When you are practicing mindfulness, you are in the moment. And really, that's the only place to be. And the more that we can practice mindfulness and being present in the moment, the better those symptoms will get.
If we know that seasonal affective disorder might be ahead, at the start of the fall, are there preventive measures you would suggest that, you know, that a person can take to perhaps forestall the worst of the symptoms?
Absolutely. So if you know that this is going to happen, let's say you're in professional help, get as much daylight as you possibly can. Don't wait till November. Keep those daylight hours all fall. Continue with the healthy eating. Big one is isolation. When we're feeling down, we tend not to want to be around others, but kind of almost make ourselves, force ourselves to keep those connections going. Spend time with friends and family. Avoid the social isolation. Snuggle with your kids, your pets. Visit friends and talk to people about how the season could be affecting you. And I would say also stay active. You know, it's really easy to stay cooped up in our houses all winter, especially add COVID into the mix. But get out there, go for a walk. Go
even
talk to
even in the cold temperatures. Bundle up, right? Yep. Get out there. Yeah.
Actually, it's really powerful. And you'll find that once you start walking, you're not as cold.
Stephanie Marcella, we'll have to leave it there. But great information. And we're so happy you joined us here this morning on the Regional Roundup. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Stephanie Marcello is Chief Psychologist at Rutgers University Behavioral Healthcare. Up next, pioneering cancer researcher Carl June will talk about two patients who've been cured of leukemia. Massive medical breakthrough. You want to hear about it. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The word cure is monumental in the world of cancer research, the holy grail for scientists seeking to defeat an opponent which until now has seemed to be all but invincible. But now, researchers at the University of Pennsylvania believe they can legitimately call CAR-T immunotherapy a cure for some patients with leukemia. A long-awaited breakthrough, which could mean revolutionary treatments for other forms of cancer, are on the horizon. CAR-T therapy, a so-called living drug, has been around for at least a decade, but extraordinary results in two patients have led researchers to take the remarkable step of changing the language around cancer and healing. Dr. Carl June is a pioneering researcher in CAR-T therapy and tenured professor at the Perelman School of Medicine, and he's here with us now to talk about this really exciting development. Carl June, welcome.
Thank you very much for this opportunity to update you on our research.
Of course. So chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy is a living drug. Remind us in layman's terms about how this works.
It's kind of unique in that, you know, the patient themselves, they are involved in making the drug. So it begins with like a blood transfusion. The patient donates some of their white blood cells in a lab, and then they're modified in our manufacturing facility at the University of Pennsylvania, you know, genetically, so that they have a molecule then that makes those white blood cells, the T cells in their blood, turns them into what we call killer CAR T cells that then stay in the patient. So unlike other therapies, it's only given one time. And the remarkable, thing we just reported last week in Nature was, you know, even 10 years later, they still had those cells in their body and still doing their job of able to kill leukemia cells.
We're talking about Bill Ludwig and Doug Olson?
Yes, those, we treated them. They were our very first two patients, you know, so we had the longest data on them. They were infused in August and September of 2010. And so we had the opportunity to go back over the past decade and ask how they're doing clinically and, you know, how are those CAR T cells doing?
So what went through your mind when you found CAR T cells present 10 years after they were initially administered to Ludwig and Olson? I mean, were you expecting this?
Well, I can tell you when we began this trial, you know, there's an informed consent procedure, and we didn't think the cells, based on the data we had from our, mouse experiments that we used to start the clinical trial, we didn't think they would last more than a month or two in the patient. So we were delighted and surprised, you know, to find that they could persist now for a decade.
So do you know, as researchers, if the cancer returned over the years in these two men and the CAR T cells simply did their job and eliminated it, or if the cancer simply disappeared altogether over the past 10 years?
So that's the $64,000 question. Did these work by basically what we would call a sterile cure, you know, eradicating every last cancer cell? Or do they work by kind of what I've called a whack-a-mole approach, which is they're there on patrol, and then if the tumor starts to come back, then it knocks it back down? All we know is at 10 years, we can't find in both of those first two patients any leukemia cells. So it's a great outcome, but we don't know that actual mechanism of how it gets there.
We are speaking with Dr. Carl June, tenured professor at the Perelman School of Medicine, and again, pioneering research into CAR T therapy, into CAR T therapy. So is 10 years of no discernible cancer the benchmark for saying this is a cure?
Well, let me just, so first of all, it depends on what kind of cancer you're talking about. Leukemia tends to, unfortunately kill most people quite rapidly, unless they've had a bone marrow transplant. Then if the tumor doesn't recur within 2 to 5 years, there's very rare relapse, meaning they're cured. Now, when we say cure, we're not, first of all, don't use that lightly. Yeah. A cure is not immortality. What it means is that statistically, it's very unlikely that tumor will ever come back. So at 10 years, that's a reasonable assumption that the leukemia was cured in these first two patients.
So, and in Doug Olson and Bill Ludwig, I mean, initially, you were perhaps, if I understand you correctly, thinking that you could give them maybe months as opposed to years with this then experimental therapy. Is that right?
That's correct. I mean, Bill Ludwig was the first patient treated. He had already, it's been covered in the previous articles, but I mean, he had arranged for his funeral and, didn't expect to live more than a month or two based on the rate of progression of his cancer. And, you know, there were no other therapies available at that time back in 2010.
I'd like to talk about an extraordinary case that really kind of grabbed the heart of so many parents, especially. A number of years ago, Carl, we spoke with your colleague, Dr. Stephen Grupp at CHOP, about a young girl, Emily Whitehead, who was dying from leukemia. I think it was called a B-cell cancer. She was enrolled in a clinical trial at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and literally brought back from the brink of death by CAR T therapy. And this was back in 2012. So if we're talking about 10 years, I mean, I haven't heard tell of how she's doing today. How is she doing today? Is she okay? And is she about to reach the 10-year benchmark?
So, well, that's, you know, we infused her back in April of 2012, as you said, Mary, at Children's Hospital. And, you know, she was like a Lazarus case where literally on death's door. I hear from her father quite often and get, you know, via the things such as these text messages. She just got her driver's license. And is applying for college and doing very well. So, you know, we don't yet have all the detailed studies on her as we did for the... She has what was called acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or ALL, and the kind that we first treated in 2010 was called chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL, which is... So they're both what are called B-cell cancers, but they're very different in how they work. And so we need to do those studies in Emily. But at this point, at least clinically, you know, she's doing very well.
So when you and your fellow researchers look at your life's work, I mean, in a case, you know, with any of these folks, you know, especially a child like Emily Whitehead, I mean, you must feel an enormous sense of what? Satisfaction when you know people. I mean, people are potentially cured of it, this deadly disease. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, it's been an amazing journey. I mean, we have a very large team of investigators at the University of Pennsylvania and Children's Hospital, and you know, there are many ongoing trials. And you know, to be able to witness this has been life changing in my case, and I would say for all the. You know, such as Dr. Grupp, who took care of Emily and continues to see her. And in the case of Bill Ludwig and Doug Olson, it was David Porter and many other physicians there at the University of Pennsylvania. So, you know, because those patients were very brave to go on the trials. They were the first humans to ever get that kind of cell therapy. And Emily was the first pediatric patient. And Bill and Doug were the first adults.
Yeah. And we should say, too, the therapy's not always easy. Some of the side effects can be pretty tough. Tell us about those and efforts to mitigate them.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. And like many first-in-human trials with drugs and cell therapies, what you find in patients is not the same as what you might find in a mouse. And so Emily in particular had a very severe, what we now call cytokine release syndrome. And it was managed with a drug that's used to treat arthritis called tocilizumab. And when the FDA approved this therapy for patients like Emily in 2017, they co-labeled a drug called tocilizumab, which is this arthritis drug. And that's routinely given as necessary now. And you know, the physicians have learned how to manage that toxicity, but it's usually occurs in the first week after therapy. It's a very high flu-like syndrome, but it's not caused by an infection. It's caused by the CAR T cells killing their tumor. And then the patient, I mean, they can go to the ICU if it's not treated and get breathing difficulties and other issues. So now it's routinely managed, but with Emily, we were kind of like flying by the seat of our pants because it was the first time it had ever been seen.
So, Carl June, CAR T therapy can offer, you know, considerable relief to people with some blood cancers, but solid tumors are a different story. How so?
Yeah, so when you put it in context, in the U.S., about 600,000 people die of cancer every year. And about 10% of those are blood cancers, and the rest are the solid tumors that you just managed. mentioned. And there now is a very large research by hundreds and hundreds of laboratories worldwide to make CAR T cells for solid cancer. And so far the results have, you know, been disappointing in that, you know, we have some responses, but it's not the kind of home runs we've seen in leukemia and lymphoma, the blood cancers. So there's a lot of research there. I think, you know, it works in mice, and the question now is how to make it work in humans and also not be toxic. And so I think over the next decade, we're going to see the same thing we've seen, you know, in blood cancers. We'll see that happen in solid tumors.
What are the challenges in a solid tumor? How does it react differently to the CAR T therapy as opposed to leukemia?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. So, you know, solid cancers, the worst of the worst are like pancreatic cancer and brain cancer. And the one major problem is that those cancers basically erect a moat, if you would, like an analogy to a castle. So it's hard for the T cells to get into the tumor. Whereas in, you know, leukemia is the blood cancer. It's in your bone marrow and places where T cells naturally go with very high efficiency. So there's this drug access issue that needs to be solved for the solid tumors.
Erect a moat. It almost sounds as if you have a living, almost thinking enemy on your hands. I mean, we know they don't think, but it almost seems that way.
Oh, it's unfortunately true. I mean, cancers, the solid cancers don't happen. If you look at the genetics, it takes only a few mutations to make a blood cancer, and then they just take off. Solid cancers, there are studies that, for instance, colon cancer, cervical cancer, can take 10 years to evolve. And during that time, they have to figure out how not to get, you know, whacked by the immune system. And so they do things like erect this moat. The blood cancers never don't even have to bother to do that. So the solid cancers are you know, much deeper problem due to that fact that they take the time to learn how to avoid the immune system.
And following this with one more question, erect a moat, what does that mean?
Well, in, you know, the old pathology literature, you know, surgeons would, for instance, in pancreatic cancer, they, when they would operate, they can literally feel the tumor as like it has a scar around it, which is the moat. They would, you know, there's a Latin word serous, which means, you know, means scar. And so that's, you know, and anytime you've had scars, that's how you make new tissue and protect it, like if you get in a bicycle accident or something. The immune system has a hard time getting into scars. And that's basically what it is. A pathologist can see that under a microscope, and it's a barrier for drugs to get in, which in part is part of the reason that these solid tumors are harder to cure with immune-based therapies.
So President Biden is relaunching the Cancer Moonshot Program. The goal is to reduce cancer deaths by half over the next 25 years. Reasonable aspiration, do you think?
I am very excited about this. You know, when he was Vice President Biden, you know, came to the University of Pennsylvania to kick off the Moonshot Initiative. And I think it focused the national, you know, the National Cancer Institute, NCI's efforts on, you know, bringing all the new science that the field has and then focusing it on actually turning that into effective therapies in patients. And I actually think that it's possible to do what, you know, President Biden now is saying. You know, we want a moonshot-like goal, and I think the science is there now to do it.
Is the funding there?
Well, that's the critical issue. You know, how do you take everything in literally thousands of different labs, you know, in the U.S. and then turn them into human trials, because those are expensive. It's a lot easier and less expensive to do these experiments in mice. So now, the funding, you know, if it's made a priority, I think, you know, we're going to get a return on that investment of, you know, because cancer incidence has been, it didn't used to be the number one cause of death. You know, when I went to medical school, the number one cause of death was heart disease, and there's been major progress on that. And now, you know, it's the number one cause of death in almost all states in the United States is cancer.
Let's get back to CAR T therapy for just a moment. The cost can be prohibitive. You know, the infusion, for lack of a better word, can cost over $400,000. But some insurers, I think, like Medicare, do cover it. How does this compare, Carl, with other cancer treatments?
Well, you know, that's really complex, Mary. It depends on, so in the United States, you know, pricing set by a variety of, depending on Medicare versus third-party healthcare and so on. And what you can say in cancer is that if you have a series of failing therapies, those are expensive too. So the average, so myeloma, it turns out, is the number one most common blood cancer in adults. And that was just approved at about the price you mentioned for myeloma, a new kind of CAR T cell in 2021. And myeloma patients, you know, with current therapies are rarely cured, but they used to have a survival of 2 to 3 months. And now with the common therapies given, they often survive for a decade. But those therapies aren't curative. And over that decade, the cost is over $1 million.
Okay.
It just spread out. So it's kind of like death by a thousand cuts.
That's a whole nother show.
Yes, it's a very interesting issue of, you know, if you can have an upfront therapy that's curative and then defray the long-term expenses, that's actually a better economic approach than having many different non-curative therapies. But this is going to take a decade to get figured out. What I can say is that there has been a lot of progress in making the CAR T cells more cheaply, just because now there's a lot of industrial effort rather than just our academic centers.
Carl, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to jump in. We're up against the clock, but it's exciting news, and we really appreciate you joining us today.
Well, thank you very much, Mary. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Carl June is a pioneering researcher into the development of CAR T therapy. Up next, the new director of the Philadelphia Library, Kelly Richards. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Recent decades have not been kind to the Free Library of Philadelphia. The library system has suffered painful budget cuts, a huge loss of staff, the threatened shuttering of some branches, and at times restricted hours. There's also been upheaval among top staff. Former library director Siobhan Reardon resigned a year and a half ago amid allegations of racial discrimination and inequity at the library. So the challenges of rejuvenating and shaping the future of this historic system are considerable. Some might say daunting. We've invited the new president and director of the Free Library of Philadelphia, Kelly Richards, to tell us about his vision for the journey ahead. Richards is former director of the Muskegon Area District Library in Michigan. He was also president of the Michigan Library Association, and he joins us now in the regional roundup. Welcome, Kelly Richards.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much.
So what drew you to leave Michigan to head this enormous and, somewhat distressed jewel of a library system?
Well, let me tell you, one day I was just sitting in my office in Muskegon, Michigan, just working, you know, planning and strategizing on how with the team to move the library district forward. And I received a phone call from a recruiter who said my name came across his desk about an opportunity. So he discussed the opportunity with me, the kind of library system, and I said, wow, that sounds very interesting. And from there, that's what sort of led to me being here. It was just such an awesome opportunity to lead such a historic library. And just sitting in my office in Muskegon, and that opportunity, you know, knocked. And I just jumped right in with the opportunity to lead a historic library in a city that I have a little familiarity with. This is the city my dad remarried when I was about 10 years old. And he remarried my stepmom, and she's from Philadelphia. So
okay.
I spent a little time here as a child.
So first day on the job, Kelly Richards, you met with staff. How was your reception, and what did they tell you?
Well, it was interesting. One of the things that I really wanted to do was just, knowing some of the issues the staff had been confronted with over the years, from budgetary issues and then from reading and understanding some of the diversity and staff morale issues. I wanted to get out and talk to the staff just to hear what they had to say. And I anticipated a really short, meetings with individuals, but, the sessions ranged from about a half an hour to an hour apiece because mm-hmm. staff really love the library system, love their branches, and love what they do. And they talked to me about, wanting to make sure that, management and staff, or from my level, and staff had a good working relationship. They wanted to be, they wanted to feel like the director was hearing it and listening to them. And their issues with funding, they wanted, funding to increase in order to better, and all of this was related to serving their patrons better.
It's more of a vocation than a job.
It was in that context. It wasn't just them. It was for the public.
Yeah. So it feels like more of a vocation as opposed to a job. It sounds like.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And if you talk with all the staff, it's kind of funny. I always say, library staff are like, cheers, the show cheers, everybody knows your name, and they're job development people. They help, patrons with their resumes. They are people who, patrons come in and ask for health information. We give them books or database information on health information. Patrons, they come in, they just want to talk because that's their public library. That's the person that they see all the time. So, and the staff are like, very multi-purpose in the kinds of services and things that they provide the public.
So, I'm just actually, kind of with an eye on the clock. I just wanted to also just get into a little bit more some of the big issues. I mean, among the most difficult challenges are the allegations of racism and discrimination staff say is affecting them. What are your initial thoughts, Kelly, about what needs to happen to make diversity and inclusion an integral part of the library staff experience?
Well, from getting out, talking with staff, has helped, develop a vision, a couple goals for me in moving forward. One of the things that I really want to do is to make sure that there is emotional intelligence throughout the organization, from management, from top level on down. That basically means treating people right, communicating with them right, respecting them for who they are, integrating them into the culture, a positive culture within the organization. So, one of the main goals that I want to do, and I found out from speaking with staff and just being here, there needs to be some training from upper level management all the way up through to me, the director, and all the way through the organization. Things that will help us relate with one another better so that we can provide a better service to the public. Because if you're happy and feel good about your work environment, you'll provide a better level of work to our patrons. Mm-hmm. And the other thing was, in regards to the budgetary issues that we have, is to really be a loud librarian, be a librarian that is respectful and understanding of our local elected officials, but be loud and explain to them. What I mean by loud is explaining to them, talking to them, communicating to them on what the library needs are and what their citizens in their areas are looking for out of the service that the library provides and what their cost is.
You did some of this when you were in Muskegon. You had to go to the voters for millage, which is essentially asking for tax dollar support. And if I remember what I read, you rallied librarians and staff around you to help communicate to the communities how important this is. Process is a bit different in Philly. Mayor Kenney and council restored the Frayed Library's funding to, I think it's about $42.5 million. Advocates say this is not nearly enough to restore aging branches and et cetera. Have you had any early communications or conversations with Mayor Kenney about funding?
Well, you know, I've talked to the mayor about three times. And even before I started the job, I talked to him about funding, you know, about one of the things that I thought would be really good to do for staff and the community, something we could just do probably relatively quick to really just show the community and staff what can be done in order to provide a better level of service. So, and that was through an interview process when I talked to him about that. But yes, we've talked about it, and he has a rebuild program that was going on before I even got to Philadelphia, trying to help improve the structure of some of the branches in the city. There's a move there to do some things by the mayor, which staff and our board greatly appreciate.
Some of the complaints from staff was that there was not pay equity when it came to staff of color and staff who were white. How is that going to be addressed? Have you had a chance to dive into that yet?
Well, you know, peripherally, I have. Not to a great detail. I'm still trying to work on building my team to address some of those issues. But we've talked about it. And I've talked to staff about some of the ways that can possibly be looked at. And, you know, I'm not going to get ahead of that right now. But I've gone around when I've gone out to the branches and just kind of thrown out some ideas of how that can potentially work, you know. And so we're going to dig into that, you know, just to see if, there's several ways you can deal with that. You know, you can look at the time that staff has worked, and maybe that particular time can add some value and promotional opportunities outside of a degree. But, you know, all of those strategies, you know, providing resources for staff to go out and, financial resources for staff to do a degree online. So there are multiple ways to address some of those issues.
Okay.
And we just need to find the best one or look at multiple ways to give staff of color and actually all of our staff the opportunity to promote up.
Kelly Richards, tell us a bit about your childhood growing up in Flint, Michigan. Books were an integral part of the family life.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up. We were one of the first people in our neighborhood, first families in the neighborhood to have an encyclopedia set. And this, you know, goes back to, you know, the late 60s, early 70s, to have the full encyclopedia set with all of the bells and whistles, all of the extra pieces to it. And it was really funny. We would sit around and read the encyclopedia because it was so cool to have that whole encyclopedia set. And because we were the only ones who had it, people around the neighborhood would come and do their homework at our house and come and get, you know, basically come to the house and check out volumes of the encyclopedia.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
And take it to
fun.
Their houses. So that was like that and my brothers, older brothers, buying comic books. And so that was my, avenue into an early world of reading and libraries.
As a younger
local library had a bookmobile.
Oh, I'm sorry.
no, go ahead.
So when you were a young adult, you served as a police officer. How did yes. you move to library work?
Well, that's a story in and of itself that some people say I can write a book about, but I'll be real short and brief. I moved out to Las Vegas after becoming, you know, a police officer in Flint. I had an opportunity to move to Las Vegas. My wife and I, we moved out there. And I did police work in Las Vegas, too. And I was looking for something different. So I was in a library one day, because the libraries have job boards and community boards. So I was in there in the library one day looking at the job board. And somehow or the other, the librarian, the head librarian there, we just struck up a conversation and had a really good talk for about an hour. And she said, hey, you know, I appreciate all the things that you do for kids and what you like to do. And I got a position open. Why don't you apply for it? So I just knew I was going to get it. I was happy. You know, I thought it'd be really cool to work in a library. So I didn't get the job and I was hurt. Mm. And she called me and she said, look, I just wanted your name in the system. There's another library across town. I think you'd be a great fit over there. So the head librarian across town, which happened to be the historical black community in Las Vegas. And she wanted a librarian over there that could relate with the community. And she hired me. And immediately she hired me to head her young people's department. Or that was the children's department, with no experience or nothing, just the love of kids, a love of trying to help people improve their lives.
And you never look back.
I took that over. I learned really quickly on what to do, taking book carts to school, milk crate carts to the schools and talking to the kids. And our circulation improved. More teachers started coming to the schools, to the library. I had, you know, more school visits, and we started doing all kinds of I just really fell in love with libraries. And from that day and from that time has led me to where I am right now. And it's just a passion and love for libraries because a friend of mine who passed away was, I met him and talked to him years and years ago. And he looked at the library as the people's university. And he was the director of the Cleveland Public Library. And I think now that's their theme.
Yeah, or People's their University. The People's University. That's great. What's on your immediate wish list for the Philly library system?
You know, the immediate wish list for me, one, is to get out and meet as many of the staff as I possibly can to kind of get a feel from them of what they're looking for in a new director and what I can do to help them better serve the community. So that's my initial wish list, is to get out, talk to the staff so that they can have an advocate in order to provide the best level of service to the city of Philadelphia's citizens.
Okay. Well, on another note, you're probably not going to get any downtime for a while, but I've read you are an avid fisherman have done some ice fishing in your time. Not sure there's much of that around here, but do you plan to explore this area? Maybe some saltwater fishing off the shore.
I am waiting because the minute that I start going fishing, I love it. And every break and every moment that I get, I'd go fishing. So right now, I'm just turning a blind eye to it because I've got so much to do and so many things to learn when it comes down to the Free Library of Philadelphia. So right now, fishing, I'm trying not to look at any water.
It's not going anywhere. Well, listen, we'll end on a listener tweet. I love the Philly Free Library. Before COVID, I did a lot of studying for my doctorate there. Love the gong at night and the dramatic announcements before closing. So welcome to Philadelphia, Kelly Richards.
Thank you. This was wonderful. Thank you very much.
So nice to meet you on the radio. Kelly Richards is the new director and president of the Free Library of Philadelphia. Our engineer is Charlie Kyer. Our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for listening. Be well.